Welcome to episode 52 for September 25th, 2007. It is with a heavy heart that I introduce this episode because it is the last episode. We're going to kick things off with a director's spotlight on a guy named Jacques Tati. And if you don't know who that is, you may want to. It sounds like one of these pretentious French guys, right? No. Fun movies that he makes. We'll have a trivia question, of course. Then we're going to deal with the second part of our series on Westerns, where Steven's going to tell us about where Westerns have gone since where I left off with them. Then we'll get a series spotlight on the Inspector Clouseau films, the Pink Panther movies by director Blake Edwards. Our top six list is going to be about movies that are about the theater or television, so competing mediums to the movies. How do the movies look at them? To wrap things up, Steven's going to teach us about how to be the underdog, especially if you're up in a sports match and your team is just so terrible. And we got an extra long episode for you this week. I am Sam Stoddard.
And I'm Stephen Keller, but Sam, do you know what they call me in France?
Stephen with cheese?
They call me Le Stephen.
Le Stephen.
You see?
Because of the metric system.
Yeah.
Oh!
That's right, exactly. The French are weird, man. I don't think we've made fun of them in a while, so I just thought bring that back here for our final episode, a final dig at France and how they pronounce things in strange ways. Good, because we're going to be talking all about La France today, so.
Coming right up after the projector sound. We got another director spotlight for you, and this week we got one that you may not have heard of. He's certainly an oddball. He just defies categorization, although we're going to try to do that anyway. It's a French director, although his movies are mostly silent, so they're pretty internationally viable. You don't have a whole lot of subtitles, because basically what we've got is a silent comedian here, but making movies in the 50s and 60s, so we're pretty well into sound. You know, nobody was really doing what Jacques Tati was doing, and that is the name of our director, and who also stars in his own movies as a character named Monsieur Hulot, and really, he's a character who's a reactor. He's taking an active part in the world, but for the most part, he's sort of the eyes that we see through, and he observes things that are a little strange about the world he lives in, and we can sort of just be carried along with him. At the same time, we're not really, as I said, we're seeing through his eyes. We're not. Actually, his movies tend to be shot only in long shots or medium shots. No real close-ups to speak of, because part of his humor is all about observing people, and the movies he made are just about people doing normal things in everyday life, but displaying them in a way that makes it funny. And to do that, you have to back off. The camera has to be kind of out of the picture. You don't want to be into it, because then you're just a part of the ordinary life, and we're in that all the time anyway. Who cares? You back off a little bit, you see things from certain angles, and suddenly everything becomes quite funny. And so that's the kind of the philosophy of his filmmaking. And again, very different. I don't know if anybody else is really doing this. So his first movie is going to be called Monsieur Hulot's Holiday. Actually, it's not his first movie at all, but it's his first movie with this character. He did maybe 9, 12 movies, depending on how you count, as a director and also as a writer and as a star. He did more as a star. But I'm just going to be zeroing in on three movies he made with this Monsieur Hulot character, which are his by far most acclaimed. And so the first one is Monsieur Hulot's Holiday from 1953, and it's a fun, kind of cute little movie where this character takes a vacation in the country. And what's interesting is, although he goes to the country, the humor is still largely about man-made things, technological things. He gets a lot of mileage out of the fact that his car is too small, and then he has a kayak that's not quite the right size, and so there's a number of things he does to kind of cope with that limitation. He has a cabin or a shack or something with a lot of things inside, and if the door is propped open, the wind comes in, and it does a bunch of kind of strange things. He's painting a boat, and the wind kind of drifts it away, but it always comes right back into position whenever he's done mixing the paint on his brush and is ready to paint again. There's a lot of things that are just kind of more, not so much outrageous belly laugh type stuff, but just little serendipitous moments of humor. They make you smile rather than laugh outright, because we're just kind of observing the oddities and the quaintness of life. And I mentioned one of his later movies, Playtime, in a recent top six list about perspective, and that's really what this is. It's a humor made entirely out of perspective. The perspective that you're seeing something from, you know, be funny from a certain angle and not at all from another. Or not just a physical angle, but from your frame of reference just in general. If you're in the situation, you're absorbed in it, and maybe it's just an ordinary thing, but if you back off a little bit and see how quaint it is, then maybe that's funny. I suspect probably all the great directors have unique perspectives, because any director can show us what we see all the time outside. You can take a camera and just go outside and film things. It's not going to be that interesting unless it's an interesting perspective that you're trying to portray, whether it's physical or something more in context. But that's more the case with Tati than anybody, I think. But, you know, when I first saw this, it's so different. I enjoyed it, but I didn't quite realize that it was great, nor did I realize his next movie, Mon Oncle, which translates into English as My Uncle. I didn't realize that was great either at first. And this movie has him visiting people who live in the suburbs. And so we're a little bit removed from nature. But again, for the most of the movie, we're at a long shot into somebody's backyard and observing the process of socialization. And so, well, how can we fit the lawn chairs all around here? As soon as they get them arranged just right, something happens, somebody leaves or somebody arrives, so they have to get up and rearrange them all over again. Or there's a hose feeding this fountain, and a fish is sprouting water out its mouth, and the owners are very proud of it, and they're showing it off to all the neighbors, but there's a leak in the hose, and so it's not working right, and Monsieur Hulot has to stand on it, and then it'll work right, but things distract him. Things like that. There's a great little scene that takes place from outside, and you're looking in the windows, and you see different windows along a hallway, and you see it all from the outside. So you see a woman who is not quite completely dressed, but she's walking upstairs. And then you see upstairs, Monsieur Hulot is walking down. And so we cut to another window, you see him walking down, and the comic tension here is, well, they're going to meet in the middle. And there's, and in a Jim Carrey movie or Robin Williams or something, there would be some outrageous behavior and shrieking and running and embarrassment and some sarcastic lines. No, in this movie, then we cut to the middle window where we see where they would have met, and we see just Monsieur Hulot's feet pointed outward, so he's facing the wall as she walks by. He's done the gentlemanly thing. You know, that either sounds like it would be cute and make you smile, or it sounds like not your thing at all. Maybe it won't be, but maybe it will be. As I said, it took me three movies to get into it. After I saw these two, I still wasn't convinced, and then I saw Playtime from 1967, and I got it. And in Playtime, I think, is his best movie anyway, but it completes a trilogy of sorts. He did do another movie with Monsieur Hulot, but in this one, huge budget, he built a city called Tativille, I think was the name of it. It's a humongous set where he built everything out of this iron, very grid-like. There's lots of grids. Grids in the parking lot, grids in cubicles, grids in the way the buildings are laid out, and even the angles, well, we see everything kind of cockeyed when the camera looks at an angle at these right angles so that we can kind of see the three-dimensionality a little better, but then there'd be strange cuts, like we'll see a scene and then we'll cut and he'll rotate the camera 90 degrees so you're looking at it from a right angle to the first perspective, and the point is it kind of exaggerates the fact that everything is compartmentalized and fit into right angles. Nature is gone now. If you look at the three movies together, the first one is going into the country, the second one's in the suburbs, now we're in the big city, and there's really no greenery or nature to be seen. It's all a man-made world, and the humor all comes from just how crazy that causes humans to behave in that world. So we get a lot of glass, a lot of steel, long corridors. Great sound as well. I mean, there's a in the beginning, there's a guy walking down an airport with a suitcase in his hand, and the tag on the suitcase is fluttering, and so that's an exaggerated sound. We hear exaggerated footsteps. We hear, quite humorously, exaggerated sounds of the cushions and chairs expanding and contracting as people sit down in them and get up. And so everything is just made to look and sound artificial. We have just lost nature here. We see little glimpses of it, like there'd be a flower stand, but it'll be on a little street corner and completely overwhelmed by buildings on both sides. And there'll be little landmarks of Paris. It all takes place in Paris. You see the Eiffel Tower, but you only see it in reflections. So this world that is just almost completely made over, and you can only sort of glimpse the old world. Everything is new and shiny and bright. It's a gorgeous-looking movie. It was shot in 70mm, and so much it was spent on the set that it actually bankrupted him, and the movie didn't make enough to recoup the losses. It was almost like Intolerance for Griffith that kind of just shattered him financially forever, but still a great movie. I mean, it just cost so much. But there's a lot of perspective humor, too. I mean, there's a great scene where a man is boarding a bus, and this is very subtle. I mean, this is the kind of thing, there's so much detail crammed into the 70mm frame. You almost have to see it on a humongous screen to see everything, but it's worth seeing on video if that's the only way you can. But there's these little details that you only see if you're zeroed in on the frame at the right time. And, for example, a man boards a bus. He's standing, he's carrying this big, long floor lamp. And so it's a, you know, there's a base and a big, shiny bar, and up at the top somewhere there's a lampshade. And he boards the bus, and he sets it down. And you don't really realize it at first, but it looks exactly like what you're supposed to hold on to when the bus is running. The bus has these bars, these vertical bars. And so then another man comes up, and he just casually stands and grabs hold of the bar. He's not really thinking about it. It just looks like what he's supposed to hold on to because it's attached to the bus, and that would be the safe thing. And then several scenes later, you see the bus stop, and the lamp lurches forward, and so does he. Strange little things like that. Details filling every little element of the frame. Great bits in a restaurant, especially, where we have protracted long shots of what's going on in a restaurant as it gradually opens and then is crowded with people, and then as it closes, you get somebody who's a couple people in a corner of the screen somewhere who are about to be served this delicious-looking dish. Waiter brings it out and spends an elaborate amount of time lavishing on sauces and spices and stirring it up and doing all these things, but then he's distracted and he goes away, and so the the people are just sitting there, you know, hey, when are we going to be served this food? It's right in front of us, but the protocol in a technological, social kind of artificial environment is not to eat the food yet. You have to have it served. And so eventually another waiter comes along and he ends up doing the same amount of spices and the same sauces and the same stirring it up. And then he's distracted, and this happens several times, and they never get to eat their food. So, you know, little fun things like that that poke fun at modern life. And as I say, they're very subtle. They're often isolated in parts of the screen that your eye isn't necessarily drawn to, and a lot of perspective humor that wouldn't be funny except that you see it from a certain angle. You see, like, for example, there's a guy behind a desk, and he is sliding along. You see only the top part of him above the desk, and he's servicing a bunch of people who are crowded all around it, and he just slides back and forth and back and forth and back and forth very gracefully. He's just, and obviously in a roller chair or something like that. But then Monsieur Hulot goes outside and looks at him from the outside through a glass window, and the glass window has a poster on it covering the top, so he's only able to see the man from behind from the waist down, and it turns out his legs are just doing crazy antics to push himself from one end of the desk to the other as he goes back and forth, and he's just nonstop movement, a total contrast to the graceful upper half of the body. So, you know, again, is that going to be hilarious to you? Would it make you smile, or is it just something you don't quite get? Maybe you have to see the movies to find out. But they're really interesting to me just because they are, as I say, nothing else like him, and he does have a really intriguing perspective of human behavior that I just haven't seen in the movies before. Don't be scared off by the fact that it's a French film from the 50s and is silent. As I say, it's a pretty accessible and international. He was actually quite an international success in the film festival world at the time, and I think he's being rediscovered on DVD today. So check out Jacques Tati with Monsieur Hulot's Holiday and Mon Oncle and Playtime. Three very great movies, although, as I say, I had to see all three before I got it. So, you know, sometimes that's what happens when you have something that's so fresh and original, you can't immediately compartmentalize it and understand, okay, this is a slapstick comedy, and I've seen these before, I know how to enjoy them. Welcome to the last trivia question for All Movie Talk. We're going to revert back to the game show format for this one, and the idea is to come up with titles of movies that have numbers in them. So, for example, if there were a movie called One Way Street, okay, that would be your first answer because it has the number one in it. And then the next step is to come up with a movie title that has the word two in it, and so on. So counting up as high as you can go. How high can you go before you get to a number where you can't think of any movie titles with that number in it? There's a caveat. And that is, you can't use sequel names that, you know, like Shrek 2 can't be your answer for number 2. You can't come up with Spider-Man 3 for 3. You can have a numeral in the title as opposed to the word spelled out, but it can't be a sequel number. So, Steven, I'm really interested to hear how you do, but we're going to wait until the end of the episode on this one.
Last week we spoke about classical westerns, talked about that genre or setting, whatever you want to call it, and this week we're going to finish that talk with a look at more modern westerns. And so, a little harder to define the modern western in some ways, but it kind of starts with probably Sergio Leone's A Fistful of Dollars from 1964. By the time of the mid-60s, the western was a really established genre or setting with a lot of distinct themes. It had been around since the dawn of film, so, you know, more than 60 or 70 years or so, we're making movies about the West. And Leone is interesting. He's an Italian who's going to be working on a bunch of B-pictures sort of in Italy, these low-budget kinds of flicks, and he directs his first film here, and it is a movie that really redefines the Western. Stars Clint Eastwood, and it's going to help Clint Eastwood really become a major star as well and make him really associated with the Western. But A Fistful of Dollars is interesting because it makes everything much darker and grittier and grimier and more violent and a little more mean and nasty. I mean, there had been dark westerns before, but this, if you've seen A Fistful of Dollars or its sequels A Few Dollars More, The Good, Bad, The Ugly, the West has become sort of a dark and oppressive place. And, of course, interesting, this is being filmed in Italy rather than on the American continent. And it is also interesting to see how a foreigner takes on such a distinctly American subject. So yeah, you have this movie about the American continent being made in Italy by an Italian, but it still feels distinctly Western. So I think that kind of shows some of the versatility of the genre. And it's just going to really make it okay in a lot of ways to make dark, gritty movies about the West. There's no real hero in this film. The Clint Eastwood character, the man with no name, is absolutely an anti-hero, and that's going to be one of the real defining points of the new Western, is that it's not going to have the classical heroes. And so we start seeing these movies crop up throughout the 60s a little more. Leone's going to keep making his films, and probably the next really important Western is one from 1969 by director Sam Peckinpah. It's a film called The Wild Bunch, and a lot of people kind of think of this as closing out the Western genre in some ways. This is a movie that's distinctly about the end of the West. It's made in 69. It feels like a 70s movie. It's dark. It's really violent. Well, I guess maybe if you're used to 80s and 90s action movies, it's not that violent, but certainly compared to other movies from the 50s and 60s, it's extremely violent.
There's a lot of blood spatter in it, yeah. Which is something that didn't really happen. You know, you shoot somebody and they clutch their chest and fall over, and it's all very sanitary. And Peckinpah was really showing how messy death is, and violence is not a pleasant thing, basically.
Yeah, and the movie is specifically, this is why a lot of people like to talk about it as sort of closing the Western genre, is because it's specifically about the end of the frontier era, about these guys who are being hunted and taken down. They're they're like the last of their kind. It's an interesting movie. It's a really good movie. It's dark. It's depressing. It's hard to watch. It kind of, you know, there's this thing about these late 60s, 70s movies where we all love them and admire them, but sometimes, you know, they get a little too dark and depressing. I think The Wild Bunch kind of falls in that for me, in that it absolutely doesn't have any of the fun of the older westerns. And then, so throughout the 70s, you kind of get these so-called revisionist westerns that are really about re-examining the West, looking at specifically the end of the West. I think of John Wayne's last film, The Shootist, from 1976, which is about this old gunslinger who's dying of cancer. Wayne had, at this point, already gone through treatments for his cancer and that kind of thing, and he was, you know, in poor health during the filming of this movie, and, you know, it's about a guy and one last kind of battle, one last kind of thing, and there are all these movies that really re-examine the various themes that we've seen in the Western. And you also get stuff like Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller from 1971 that are kind of just, you know, contemporary directors using the Western to explore their own sorts of themes, not exploring the typical themes at all. But for a large part, by the end of the 70s, the Western's kind of, if not dead, then on complete and total life support. Before the show, Sam and I were talking a little bit about, were there any good Westerns made in the 80s? And, you know, there are a few, but if you look at the list of Westerns from the 80s on Wikipedia or something, just this handful of Westerns really, really kind of just disappears. And then for some reason in the 1990s, it sort of reappears. Right in 1990 is Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves, which is an interesting film in that it's sort of a return to the classic, elegant, epic Western. Now, it was really critically acclaimed. It won the Best Picture Award that year, and it's interesting in a lot of ways because it doesn't have the same dark grittiness that Peckinpah Western or Leone Western would have. It feels more elegant.
Right. Instead, it's unbelievably pompous instead. So.
yeah, it is a little... But it is interesting in a sense that it does kind of do some interesting things. Particularly its portrayal of American Indians, I think, is pretty well praised for being somewhat more nuanced than the typical Western portrayal of Indians. Interesting in that sense, but I think I'll agree with Sam that Dance with Wolves was definitely overrated in 1990. I think part of it was just people were happy to see a Western come back that wasn't the most dark and depressing thing you'd ever seen. Well, in 1992, we get Clint Eastwood's retake on the Western as a director. He'd been directing Westerns since the 70s when he was in them, but this really kind of looks at him. He's cast himself as the star, and he delivers a great performance, and this is him as an older guy now, and he's this old gunslinger who's retired and gets called back out of retirement. You know, kind of that typical movie thing for one last job. He doesn't really want to do it, but there's, you know, extenuating circumstances, and he needs the money, and it's for a good cause. So, it's for a good cause. It's about revenge. And this is a movie that's about a meditation sort of on... It's very dark in a sense, but it's a meditation on vengeance and violence and what it does to a person, and how would that life of the old Western gunslinger affect you? Now, it's a dark film, but I don't know. It also just doesn't seem like as much of a tragedy to me as The Wild Bunch or something like that. It seems like there's a little bit of hope in the movie, a little bit of a glimmer of hope in the film. I don't know. Do you agree with that, Sam?
Or very little.
Very little. Yeah.
I think it's very little there. It's not just Clint Eastwood returning to the genre that he had been a lot more active in 10 and 20 years earlier. It's also a look at the gunslinger, the hero characters of the 40s and 50s, maybe, or maybe even the anti-heroes, the villains that didn't get shot down by the good guys. How would their lives have turned out if they had wanted to try to change them? Basically, if you're a gunslinger, you're going to die with a bullet in the back someday, but if you make an effort to get out of that lifestyle, well, can you really do it? Can you really leave it behind? And so there's that going on, but then there's also Clint Eastwood saying, well, those people I played 20 years earlier, where are they now? There's a bit of both going on.
Right. And then throughout the 90s, we get a handful of kind of more traditional Westerns. We get, in 1993, two films, for all of a sudden, kind of out of the blue, about Wyatt Earp, the classic, you know, sometimes outlaw, sometimes lawman. We get Kevin Costner's sort of long and dry take on his life, the film Wyatt Earp, which I'm not a very big fan of. I think it's a little too long and slow, but definitely sort of a return Costner, more the elegant, epic Western. And actually, we also get the flick Tombstone, which I actually like. like quite a bit from the same year. It's kind of a fun popcorn flick. But to me, Tombstone represents a real return to the old-school kind of Western idealism in a sense. It's not at all dark and gritty. It's kind of a modern action film set in the West in a lot of ways, but I don't know. It's a lot of fun, and I enjoy it.
Val Kilmer's Doc Holliday is fantastic, and I am not the world's biggest Val Kilmer fan, but he is just wonderful in that movie.
It's a lot of fun. Yeah, I like Tombstone. I think it's a little bit of an underrated flick, because, in a sense, it's not a dark, ponderous movie. It's not depressing. You kind of get out of it. You don't feel terrible once you're done watching it, which I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Well, but all of a sudden, right now, I'm not sure why, but we seem to be in the middle of some rebirth of the Western. We've had a lot of kind of critically praised Westerns lately. In 2003, we had Open Range, another Kevin Costner epic Western. Just recently, in 2005, we had a couple of critically praised Westerns that didn't get really big releases. Tommy Lee Jones's The Three Burials of Melquiades Estrada, and also The Proposition, a movie about an Australian outlaw starring Guy Pearce. And all of a sudden, just this year, in 2007, we've got a couple of Westerns, big-budget kind of big releases. 310 to Yuma, which is in theaters right now, and I've just seen, is a really sort of classical Western I'll talk about in 1 second. Also upcoming is The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which, boy, is a long title, and it's going to star Brad Pitt. And also P.T. Anderson, the guy who did Magnolia and Boogie Nights, his new film will be called There Will Be Blood, which is about Texas oil men at the turn of the century, which sounds really intriguing to me. But I don't know, it's kind of interesting. I want to talk a little bit about 310 to Yuma. We've seen all these anti-Westerns or revisionist Westerns. And here is a movie that I've just seen, and I really, really liked it. It's gotten very good reviews, and it absolutely deserves it. It's a remake of an earlier film, and both were actually based on a short story by Elmore Leonard, which makes you go back and think, how freaking long has Elmore Leonard been writing stories to get adapted by the movies? I think actually this was one of his original movie adaptations, but it's a story that stars Christian Bale as this rancher with one leg who's just down on his luck, and it's a sort of typical Western kind of thing where the railroad's going to take his land, he's got nothing, and so he ends up volunteering to be part of this posse that's going to escort the outlaw Russell Crowe to this train where he's going to be taken to the Yuma prison. His whole gang, the whole Russell Crowe gang's out to kill all the people who are escorting him, and so, you know, Christian Bale has to do this. And it's about, it becomes, in sort of the traditional Western sense, you know, it starts off where you just think, you know, Christian Bale just needs the money he's going to get from doing this job, but it really becomes about standing up for himself and proving that he's not a coward, proving that he is a man. And I can't think of a more traditional Western theme in a lot of ways than that one there, that the idea that you have to sometimes make a stand. And it's got a very sort of High Noon kind of feel to it, as did, I guess, the original, which I haven't seen the original 310 to Yuma, but I hear it's kind of very similar, where it's, you know, one man versus the world standing up when everyone else has abandoned you. What surprised me the most about 310 to Yuma is that it's not at all couched in irony. I mean, it absolutely embraces these old ideals and the values of the classic Westerns. It says, you know, it's okay to feel this way. It's okay. It's just unabashedly sentimental and saying, I'm going to do what I got to do, and, you know, a man's got to do what a man's got to do, that kind of thing. It was interesting. Roger Ebert, in his review for 310 to Yuma, says that the Western will never fully go away because it is a sort of way for America to constantly reevaluate itself, and as it goes through different troubled times or just different times period, the West, the sort of common American heritage, the distinctly American component to our movies, the most American of all genres, it's a way for our country to look at itself and use that older setting as a way of considering what our values are now. So in that sense, maybe the Western can never really go away. I don't know, what do you think, Sam? Is the Western going to come back? Is this a fad? Can it ever go away?
I don't know. I think it may go, like a lot of things, come in and out of fashion. But what's really interesting about the Western, and I agree with what Roger Ebert is saying, is it's quite an adaptable genre. It's not really a genre, actually. It's basically a setting. And a traditional sort of Western, it does imply something about your genre. It's probably going to be an action-adventure, maybe thriller type of thing. Could just be a drama, but it could be a comedy too. It could be, you know, Support Your Local Sheriff with James Garner or Maverick. It could be anything, really. You can do anything in that setting if you want to. And so what that allows is filmmakers to address the current times without literally addressing the current times. Westerns normally be set around the late 1800s, but in reality, what they're commenting on is today. And so you go back to World War II era Westerns or 1930s era Westerns. Actually, we recently talked about how Stagecoach is a really 1930s kind of a movie. You go to World War II and you talk about heroes and you talk about doing the right thing. In the 70s, we had, there had been a lot of things that had disillusioned the American public with heroes. They had the Vietnam War, you had Watergate, you had all these different things, and suddenly heroes disappeared from the Westerns, and those movies are about contending with a world that doesn't have heroes. So whatever's going on at the time, I'm sure we'll get the terrorism Westerns. If we haven't, some of these recent ones, if those aren't already about that, I mean, I'm sure somebody's going to do those eventually. It's a very adaptable genre and allows us to talk about things without literally talking about them. And the advantage to that is you don't hit people's hot buttons. You can talk about George Bush and terrorism without taking a side that immediately polarizes your audience. You can just say, okay, let's step back from that. Let's just throw out all that stuff and talk about the themes and just in general, what's going on here? What's the right thing to do in these sorts of circumstances? And your message is a lot more effective that way. So no, I don't really see the Western going away. I mean, it's a beautiful setting. You've got wide open plains. You've got a world of possibility around you when you have this just open landscape and everything's at your feet. There's all kinds of things you can do with a Western.
So let me ask you that. Maybe I narrow the question. Can the classical Western make a comeback? Are we too jaded for movies? I mean, I think 310 to Yuma, it has some modern sensibilities, and it is sort of darker. It's more of the High Noon kind of classical Western. It's not the limitless possibilities of the frontier kind. Could that kind ever come back? Are we too jaded? Do we need irony? Can we not embrace those sorts of raw sentiments the way we used to be able to?
Yeah, I think it can come back. I don't know if it will in the near future or not. It depends on what people want. The other thing, though, about the way genres seem to evolve is it's weird. We diversify as we change as well. It seems like the old forms never go away. So you say 310 to Yuma is kind of like a classic Western, and will that ever take over and dominate? I don't think so. There'll always be these little offshoots. If you go to a 30s gangster movie, you know what you're getting. If you go to a 90s one, who knows? You got to look at the director and the stars and reviews and the MPAA rating, and then maybe that'll tell you what it is, whether it's Goodfellas or Mickey Blue Eyes. We get this history of genres behind us, and so that allows filmmakers to draw upon the ones that inspire them individually.
That's a very interesting point. I hadn't thought about that, I guess. I just personally would like more sci-fi Westerns, like Serenity, though I know you weren't a fan of that.
Wild Wild West 2, how's that?
I meant more like spaceships and horses in the same movie, because that's my favorite thing in the entire world. Okay, so I don't have a wrap-up.
Okay. This is the end of our coverage of Westerns.
Yeah, is that it? Are we done?
So we come now to a series spotlight on the Pink Panther films, the Inspector Clouseau films more specifically. And these are a series of movies that have been made since 1963, starring mostly Peter Sellers as the Inspector Clouseau character, and other people have played him not quite so successfully. Well, not nearly so successfully. I guess Steve Martin in the reboot of the franchise has done a good enough job that they're going to do a sequel to that one. But let's not talk about that. Let's just talk about the original series, directed by Blake Edwards in 1963. And this first movie, The Pink Panther, well, first of all, The Pink Panther refers to not the character Inspector Clouseau, but a diamond, a Pink Panther diamond that's worth a lot of money and has a kind of a pink color, and it's, the focus of several of the movies. Not all of them. Some of them are called the Pink Panther something or other and have nothing to do with the diamond, because the Pink Panther is a recognizable name to put in the title. It's kind of like how the Thin Man stopped being about the Thin Man in that series of movies. But anyway, Blake Edwards is a director that's worth talking about, and we haven't really talked about him before. He's a guy that's directed a lot of really popular comedies over the years, and he's also directed at least one noteworthy drama called Days of Wine and Roses with Jack Lemmon, and that's kind of a companion to The Lost Weekend by Billy Wilder, which we have talked about in terms of a portrayal of the destructive cycle of alcoholism. But other than that, his movies are mostly these really fun kinds of comedies. My favorite is actually The Great Race from 1965, which we mentioned briefly in passing last week when we talked about westerns. But the Pink Panther movies kind of came about by accident almost. The first movie was kind of an ensemble. It wasn't really a starring vehicle for Inspector Clouseau. In fact, the top-billed actor was David Niven, and he was the thief that was going to steal it. And Jacques Clouseau was the inspector on the case. And he wasn't completely defined as a character, but it was clear that he was the one that stole all his scenes, and so, hey, let's use this character again. It's a good movie. Not a great movie, actually, the first one. It's not one of these series where the first movie is so great and the rest kind of decline over time. This first movie, it's good, but scenes go on a little bit long, and it could be cut down, I think, by making individual scenes a little tighter and faster paced, and that would make it a better movie. But not bad. Much, much better is the next movie, A Shot in the Dark, which makes a starring vehicle for Peter Sellers as Inspector Clouseau. But what's funny about this is it wasn't originally supposed to have him in it. It was based on a stage play that has nothing to do with Clouseau. And it's just a comedy in the vein of, say, an Agatha Christie mystery, where you get a bunch of people in a mansion, and somebody is killed, and, well, who did it? So Inspector Clouseau is sent over to solve the case, and, of course, as usual, what he does is he solves it, but by accident. And that's kind of the secret to the character, I think, that he always figures out how to solve... Well, he doesn't figure it out. He always solves it somehow, but it's always by accident. He always stumbles upon the solution, stumbles upon catching the killer, and whatever. And so what happens is, throughout the series, he is promoted. You know, he becomes chief inspector later on, and you know, everybody thinks he's great. He's France's best detective. But then if you meet him, well, you figure out that, you know, he's a complete idiot. And, in fact, this drove his boss, played by Herbert Lom, starting in this movie, A Shot in the Dark. Herbert Lom is one of these great character actors. You know the face, you may not know the name, but I really like Herbert Lom, and he plays Inspector Clouseau's boss, Chief Inspector Dreyfus. And, you know, throughout the series, he just is driven literally insane by Clouseau, because he always takes the glory and drives him mad in the first place. I mean, you know, you get Inspector Clouseau in your office, and it'll probably burn down or something like that. it's just part of the character.
Yeah, you know, I think Shot in the Dark is probably my favorite of the Pink Panther movies. And I agree with what you say, where, you know, maybe in the first movie, Clouseau is not that well-defined, and here we start to see him really come into his own. They realize that, you know, it's Sellers in this role who's so funny. And touching on what you said about, you know, him accidentally solving the case, I think it's a real sort of tradition of this kind of a character in comedies. You know, this sort of thing you saw in The Silent Era. Right? Charlie Chaplin almost could have done this. You know, you think of how many of Chaplin's characters or Keaton's characters accidentally accomplish some great feat. Not even, you know, you think of Buster Keaton in The General, he accidentally accomplishes all this, you know, kind of not really realizing what's going on. He focuses sort of single-handedly on his own thing, and it's just, I don't know why it's such a funny notion, the idea of a total bumbler doing things by accident, and then everyone thinks he's a total genius. And of course, Sellers would later sort of play on that in a different way with Being There, a film we've talked about before, where as this sort of, you know, not quite all there kind of guy, everyone thinks that he's a genius because of these, you know, accidentally insightful, really not insightful things that he says. So clearly this is something that Sellers is really good at playing.
That's a really interesting couple of comparisons there to Being There and to silent film. You're right about the silent movies. I never would have made the connection, though, I don't think myself, just because these are not silent movies. These are very definitely, I mean, even Clouseau is not a silent movie character by any means, because half the comedy comes from his fake French accent. And actually, that's sort of interesting, because the first two movies, including Shot in the Dark, his accent is a little more realistic. And as the series progresses, he just decides to make it a completely over-the-top, ridiculously crazy, thick French accent to the point where even the other French characters don't understand him. You know, he said, "Do you have a room?" "Room? What do you mean?" You know, a room in a hotel. And there's some great dialogue about clearing that misunderstanding up, because the other thing about Clouseau is he has this great ego. In fact, Sellers said this was the secret to the character. He has this great ego, and his favorite example was if somebody says, you know, "Phone call for Inspector Clouseau," and Clouseau would say, "Ah, yes, that would be for me." And so great example. But the other way that ego manifests itself is if he messes up, if he falls down the stairs, if he somebody tells him something that he obviously didn't realize or whatever, he will try to recover no matter what, no matter, it could be completely hopeless. In fact, a shot in the dark, he's trying out these parallel bars and he dismounts, and the way he dismounts is by flying over down the stairs, and he falls down the stairs into a room with a whole bunch of people, and he picks himself up, and he looks around, and he realizes that everybody saw him roll down the stairs, and he says, "Ah, that felt good." And then he'll proceed to question them. And, you know, that questioning scene, I think, that follows is my favorite scene of the series. It's just brilliant. I won't go in and try to describe it, but definitely just see this movie just for that scene. But it's a great movie anyway. So what happened from here, though, is that Blake Edwards, directing these movies, and Sellers had a falling out. And they basically said, well, you know, we can't work together anymore, and we're not going to do this. So the Clouseau character was put on the shelf for a little while, and in 1968, it was brought back, but without them. A different director, Bud Yorkin, and a different star, Alan Arkin. And people don't really know this movie too well. I mean, it doesn't have Sellers, so it doesn't have the maybe the appeal that that the other movies have. But it did influence the series. Arkin's performance is really quite good. It's not really an imitation of Sellers. It is its own thing, but you can clearly see that it's the same sort of character. And it advanced the character a bit, too. It fashioned the crazy accent a little bit. It fashioned his mode of dress. And it refined the character, polishing it up a bit, so that when Sellers and Edwards reconciled and re-teamed up in the early 70s for Return of the Pink Panther, then now, suddenly, this is the character that is fully fledged. It is a perfect thing, well understood by Sellers and everybody making the movie. And so you can really see, ah, yes, I recognize everything I know about Clouseau in starting with this movie, Return of the Pink Panther, which had Christopher Plummer playing the jewel thief this time. This one did actually have the Pink Panther diamond in it. And that's a good movie. It starred a lot of the trademarks. It's a great opening scene where Clouseau is discovering a beggar with a monkey, and he's he says, "Do you have a license for the Minky?" "Minky? You said Minky." "Yes, I know that." Meanwhile, they're in front of a bank, and it's being robbed right behind Clouseau, and he doesn't notice that the robbers are there until the last one is running out and drops a bag of money, and Clouseau picks up the money and hands it to him, you know, to be polite. So he's going to get chewed out by Herbert Lom, but everything works out all right, because it does always accidentally work out all right. Return of the Pink Panther is the one you don't tend... Well, Inspector Clouseau doesn't tend to show up in collections either, but Return of the Pink Panther doesn't, because the rights are a little weird. This was supposed to be a TV series at first, based on the Clouseau character, and then eventually it was decided to make it a movie instead, and because of that weirdness, you often, if you buy like the Pink Panther movie collection, you'll miss this one, so you have to seek it separately. So the next one is actually my favorite movie in the series, and it is The Pink Panther Strikes Again. The idea of this one, I'm not sure why it's my favorite, actually. I think it just has the most classic scenes in it. In fact, there's even really good throwaway moments. Like, there's this bit where Sellers is at his desk, and he's leaning back, and he gets stuck in the reclining chair. He can't seem to tip forward again. Well, there's another guy standing there leaning over the desk as they're looking at paperwork together. And Clouseau very casually just kind of grabs onto the guy's tie to pull himself up. And, of course, what that does is this pulls the other guy's head head into the desk, and it's not really played up. It's just kind of a motion that's very casually done there, and because of that, it's so surprising that it's just a riot. And it also has some crazy disguises. Clouseau is really, really trying here to do some crazy, crazy detective kind of things. He knows that detectives sometimes put on disguises, so he'll put on this ridiculously crazy hunchback kind of disguise with this ridiculous rubber mask on his face, and then he'll also be trying to be suave for the women, and so he'll be trying to do the macho thing, but of course falling over and tripping on things and all that kind of stuff. He can't get his tie off toward the end. It just won't come off the top of his head, so he just leaves it there like some kind of a bandana tied around there. It just looks absolutely ridiculous, but Clouseau has that unfailing ego, and he will not ever stop trying to recover from looking ridiculous. So, again, that's the secret to the character. I think that's what sets it apart from just, you know, imitations or just other bumbling sorts of slapsticky characters. Slapstick isn't really a respected genre at all. I think people just kind of categorically consider it a stupid and lowbrow form of comedy, and to be fair, it usually is. But you can be intelligent with that. One of the top six lists that I had an idea for and never got to was the top six intelligent slapstick comedies, and I think this is one of those.
Yeah, what you say about intelligent slapstick is kind of interesting. It's weird, though, because I get what you mean, but on the other hand, like, if you haven't seen the Clouseau movies, I don't know if intelligent slapstick necessarily makes it clear exactly what you're going to get here, because you're definitely not going to be getting highbrow movies exactly, but you're also not getting movies that are stupid, right? This isn't, you know, this isn't Scary Movie whatever with just like random dumb jokes that aren't funny. There are jokes like, you know, take you having to pay attention, but they're hardly, you know, highbrow jokes that are going to really, like, require you to really think about them too much. It is kind of a weird classification. I kind of like the term intelligent slapstick. I just hate for people to think that, you know, these are, you know, really highbrow, artsy kind of movies when they're absolutely not.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. That's a good clarification. What I mean by that is that it's slapstick based on a real character. This character, Clouseau, feels like a real person. He's exaggerated, but he is an exaggerated form of people you do see in real life and you can imagine actually existing to a point. I mean, you're not going to think that he's going to accidentally solve all sorts of crimes and catch killers and stuff, but who doesn't know somebody who's a little bit full of himself and a little bit too eager to puff himself up and make himself look good? We all know people like that, and Inspector Clouseau is just an exaggerated form of that. So it's slapstick, it's people falling down, it's crazy verbal humor, making fun of accents and that kind of thing, but it has a center that feels a little bit authentic, and the humor is true to that character. I guess that's what I mean by that.
Yeah, I can definitely get behind that and agree with that. Makes a lot of sense. Though, I mean, again, important note, Clouseau is a developed character, but he's also not exactly realistic when you say that. He's definitely a caricature. And again, I go back to, he reminds me of a silent film comedian in a sense. He's got that kind of weird, almost believability, but exists clearly in his own little universe. It absolutely kind of reminds me of the sort of character that Chaplin or Keaton or any of the other silent comedians could have played some version of, though, like you say, the verbal comedy is very, very important.
Yes. Okay, well, the next movie is Revenge of the Pink Panther, 1978. We're at the end of the 70s now, and this is a good movie. It's a bit of a decline from the previous couple, but a pretty good one. But it's the last movie that is made by Sellers. Sellers would die before the next movie could be made. They were preparing one called Romance of the Pink Panther, and that, I guess, was something that Peter Sellers was pretty excited about directing himself, but I guess the studio was going to go with Sidney Poitier. I'm not sure why Edwards wasn't involved in it at that point. If you've seen the movie The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, it actually gets this story wrong, so don't go by that as the truth. But basically what happens is this movie goes through a couple of drafts and is thrown out. And in 1982, Blake Edwards makes Trail of the Pink Panther as an homage to Peter Sellers. And what he does is he makes this story about finding Clouseau. Clouseau has gone missing, and there are flashbacks and things like that, but basically the footage of Sellers in this is a bunch of outtakes and other footage that he had lying around, just kind of assembled it into a movie. It's an interesting idea, but it's a really bad movie. And in fact, Sellers' widow sued about this movie defaming the memory of Sellers and won, you know, $1.5 million on that lawsuit. So, yeah, it's kind of a failed idea, but an interesting one. And then Edwards made another one. Actually, these two were filmed at the same time, Trail of the Pink Panther and Curse of the Pink Panther, released the next year, which has a new character played by Ted Wass, who is a guy who is trying to find Sellers, and he's his own form of bumbling detective, and it's not very good. Pretty bad movie as well, except the last few scenes are quite good, because Clouseau does show up again, and I won't say any more than that. It's a great surprise if you don't know in what form he shows up and why and everything. So this is a great scene at the end, but otherwise not that great of a movie. But it is a masterpiece compared to 10 years later. We get Son of the Pink Panther, starring Roberto Benigni as Clouseau's illegitimate son by one of the characters in A Shot in the Dark. The less said about this, the better. I mean, it's absolutely terrible, and what's really unfortunate is that it is apparently going to be Blake Edwards' last movie. Edwards is still around, but he hasn't directed a movie since then, and it's just ridiculously awful. It is so terrible, and Stephen, you've seen this a lot or something? What's...
Well, for some reason, Comedy Central, which I spent a lot of the early 90s just watching constantly for mysterious reasons. I just watched whatever they were showing, no matter how terrible it was, and they were showing this movie a whole lot back in the day. I don't know why they were or why I kept watching it, but yeah, you know, it's one of those things where I just fixated on how terrible this movie is, and it really is. It's like everything that is good about the series just inverted so that you get dumb, terrible, unfunny slapstick. And it's even worse to see a fairly talented actor like Benigni going through and just, ugh. It's not describable, really, how terrible this movie is.
Yeah, I think the main problem, and of course that's saying a lot because there's a lot of problems here, but the character of his son is too self-conscious. The whole point of Clouseau is that he has no idea. I mean, he has this vague little inkling that he has to puff himself up and kind of recover. He knows that if he's made a fool of himself and he can recover from that. But the basic idea is he really has no concept of the scope of his incompetence. And the son character that Benigni plays is just, I don't know what he's doing. He knows he's funny or thinks he's funny anyway, and that just ruins it. It's terrible. So skip that one. And in fact, skip the last three. Just watch first one through Revenge of the Pink Panther, and I think you'll find that you know, these are really, really well put together comedies for the most part with great characters. I haven't mentioned, I got through this without mentioning, it's one of my favorite elements of the series is Clouseau is always coming home and going, Kato, I'm calling off the attack for tonight! And anyway, Clouseau has made such an impression that actually in some countries the name is used as a derogatory term for a policeman. And basically, you mean, okay, you're a guy who can't even solve the simplest case. You're a Clouseau. And that's how much these movies have pervaded culture around the world. So, interesting situation. So, check these movies out and give a look to just Blake Edwards' movies in general, because he's got a lot of interesting ones. Welcome to our last top six list ever, maybe. It's our 50th anyway, 52 episodes. We had two specials, so it's our 50th anniversary top six list edition special. It's got the updated special effects. Anyway, it's about movies that are about other forms of narrative entertainment, specifically television and theater. So what do the movies have to say about its competition, basically, is what we're going for here. So movies that are about television or theater. Back in episode 6, we did a top 6 list about movies, and that was a pretty neat look at how movies see themselves, but now we're going to go for the other guy. So we're going to kick things off with my number 6, a pretty recent movie, one that got a lot of awards attention, but maybe wasn't seen by a lot of people that I think would like it, Stephen. And that would be my number 6 choice, Good Night and Good Luck, from 2005, by director George Clooney. He also stars in it. But the real performance you remember in this would be by David Strathairn, who played Edward R. Murrow. And he called out McCarthy and had a number of broadcasts that are quite famous about him just addressing the idea of the blacklist and that whole deal. There aren't a lot of movies made about the blacklist, actually, so this makes it doubly interesting, or interesting for another reason. But it is just, this is a fascinating look, quite a complimentary look that the movies take toward television. And I think journalism gets a bit of a pass when the movies talk about television. They love journalists, and so you get movies like The China Syndrome and this, Good Night and Good Luck. But this is a beautifully made movie as well. It's done in black and white, and that fact, as well as the set design and the costumes and everything, really evoke a feeling of the 1950s, and that power that these personalities had. Edward R. Murrow was a very powerful and a figure that is similar to maybe Walter Cronkite in the sense that when he spoke, you listen. He had something about him that conveyed force in his words, but in a way that people respected. So that really comes through in the performance, and the movie in general is just great to watch, even though it doesn't maybe sound that interesting.
Yeah, a movie you said went unseen by many, including me, so definitely it's on my list, though. Okay, my number six is also a TV movie, and, well, I shouldn't say TV movie, a movie about TV, rather, from 1998, a film called The Truman Show. Really a movie where I think everyone kind of realized that Jim Carrey, in particular, was a really talented actor, in addition to just being a sort of comic goofball. The premise, if you don't remember, is about a guy, and actually pretty prescient in some ways, sort of really predicted the reality TV explosion of the 2000s. But here's a movie where this guy has spent his entire life growing up on television. Like, he doesn't know it. Everything he does is filmed 24/7. There's basically a Truman Channel where you can just watch this guy, everything that he does. And very, very clever in some of the ways it satirizes TV and some of the stuff TV does. I love all the product placement gags where, you know, people, since they don't have commercials, it's 24/7 of this guy, right? And his friends will walk in and say, boy, this, you know, brand of beer is a really great beer, don't you think? And basically deliver a little product placement right there, a little commercial, without Truman ever quite realizing what's going on until, of course, the sort of the story arc of the film is him realizing there's something wrong with his world. And interesting, too, because it has a lot to say about the artifice of television, the way that things are carefully manufactured and controlled. And I think what's going to be interesting about a lot of these movies is, you know, we say that these are movies about the competition to movies, but I think most of the stuff on my list in some way reflects on the movies themselves as well. Because, you know, television, the stage, and film share just a lot in common. You know, television isn't any more artificial than film in a way. So when Peter Weir, the director of The Truman Show, is commenting on the artifice of television, he could just as easily be commenting on the artifice of film. It's just, I think, generally that movies do a better job of seeming more realistic and natural than television.
Yeah, and there's another aspect to that movie I particularly like, and that's its commentary on directors. The director of The Truman Show is played by Ed Harris, and I love Ed Harris, but it kind of makes a little more literal the idea that directors have a god complex, or certainly can. I mean, they can control the whole world. They don't like somebody in the background wearing a particular costume. Well, change it. You know, this is a powerful position to be in. And in this movie, basically, Ed Harris's voice comes out of the sky. Not very subtle at all. It's quite literal and amusing for it. This is a funny movie, even though it's a pretty serious subject, and Jim Carrey's performance is quite serious.
The Ed Harris character in that reminds me a lot of the Peter O'Toole character from The Stuntman.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of similarities there.
All right, well, number five for me, also a movie that shows you a side to what we think of a more comic actor that you might not think of, but this one came before the roles he became famous for, and that would be the movie A Face in the Crowd from 1957 by Elia Kazan, not to mention The Blacklist again, but the lead performance in this was Andy Griffith. It was his first movie, and wow, what a powerful, dramatic performance this is. He wasn't nominated for the Academy Award, but it's the kind of performance where you'd think he would be. I'm actually kind of surprised not to see him among the nominations, but basically, this guy is not a nice guy. He's pretty much a jerk. He's a drunk, he's a selfish person, he's obnoxious, belligerent, and for whatever reason, the television viewing audience finds him just, they really just click with him. All of a sudden, they like the guy. They just love everything that he's saying and how he says it, and, you know, he becomes a superstar on TV. And as things go, as he's rising to power, he starts to realize he has pull and can push his weight around a bit more, and becomes all the more obnoxious for it. And so it's a kind of a power trip movie. You see a lot of these in political movies, as, you know, candidates who want to do the right thing start campaigning, and as they become popular, they're more and more pressured to compromise, and then they become power-hungry jerks. This is that kind of a story, but with definitely about, rather than politics, the idea of what television can do to bring somebody, a celebrity, in your home every week or every day or whatever. I mean, in 1957, definitely the country was still sort of exploring the potential of the medium of television and realizing how powerful it was. And so this movie is a really great look at that, and I think it's still quite relevant today. But yeah, great performance. And where does it come from? This is the guy you know from the Andy Griffith Show and Matlock, and it's just amazing to see, go back and look at this movie and realize what dramatic power and what a completely unlikable guy he can play.
Huh, so Andy Griffith playing a television star? That seems like a...
Yeah, it's a bit of a stretch.
A bit of a stretch, right.
But it was before he became one, so that adds a dimension when you watch it today.
That's like extra irony, because the irony was not intended, so that's like double irony. Anyway, moving on, my number five pick is Moulin Rouge, the great Baz Luhrmann film from 2001, a movie all about the stage. And what I love about it is this isn't a sort of normal movie about show business. It's kind of crazy and insane, and obviously super anachronistic. It's supposed to take place at the turn of the century, but there's all this modern pop music in it, and it's really crazy. But I love the way, especially, say, the first 20 minutes of the film, the way that you really get a sense of the craziness that if the Moulin Rouge and the turn of the century didn't actually look the way that this film does, we hope it did. This is how we want to imagine, you know, the crazy French theater with the bohemian lifestyle and all that, this barrage of colors and sounds and music and who knows what else all coming at you. Just a wonderful depiction of, you know, the sort of ideal type of stage performance you might go and see. And it's, you know, throughout the movie, it kind of loses a lot of the focus sometimes on the fact that it's supposed to be about a play or acting or something. In fact, a lot of the plot details kind of just get lost as it moves along, but I still really like it. I do like the way that, even from the very beginning, there's lots of jokes about the way that the money financing the play that they're working on keeps wanting to alter the ending and alter parts just to suit his own purposes. I think that's kind of a, you know, maybe kind of common in these sorts of things, but still works here, and I like watching the creative process as they go through putting together this production, even if I'm never really sure that the production that we see is much like the one that they were working on the whole time, but still a great flick.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked Moulin Rouge. Moulin Rouge, of course, is, as people who listen to this podcast know, one of my favorite movies of recent years. Number four for me is also a theater movie. It's the Woody Allen movie Bullets Over Broadway from 1994. Woody Allen directed, did not star. The character, the Woody Allen character, is actually played by John Cusack in this. And this was made in the mid-90s, and it was a time when Woody Allen wasn't doing too many comedies, and this one came along, and I think people really liked it. It was one of the more popular Woody Allen movies from this period. And it just does a great job of satirizing Broadway in the process of putting on plays. And I suspect a lot of it is semi-autobiographical, because Woody Allen began his career doing plays. So John Cusack is a playwright, and he has all the neuroses you'd expect, but he's the one, as neurotic as he is, he's the one guy who has any sense at all in this theater production. So he finds a way to have a play produced. It involves a run-in with the mob, but never mind. You got all the stereotypes. You got the actress who is really terrible and stupid and obnoxious, but is somehow, you know, maybe friends with the director, maybe whatever. She has to be the star, and so have to deal with her and pet her ego and everything. But then there are other people that have their other issues as well, and just it seems like you, if a play actually makes it to the stage, it's a minor miracle, because there's all these personalities that just should not ever mix, and you force them into a position where they have to mix because the show must go on.
Okay, well, my number four pick is a movie I'll be surprised if Sam doesn't include on his list, because I think he likes it more than I do, but it's Pleasantville from 1998 by director Gary Ross, a movie all about television in sort of a strange way. The idea is that these modern-day characters get transported into a 1950s sitcom, the fictional Pleasantville, and once they get there, they kind of bring modern values to this, you know, like the kind of Leave It to Beaver style sitcom with these sort of fake 50s values throughout. They bring their model ideals, and it's all about how this changes the entire world that they live in. Really famous for the way that it illustrates, quite interestingly, these sort of bringing modern ideals to past society, because when they get in the television show, it's all black and white, and as they slowly start changing the world, things start turning into color, and just a really, really dramatic use of computer effects. I think, you know, when we think about great CGI work, this is something that doesn't necessarily get thought of, but in terms of being one of the first movies to extensively rely on CGI, this deserves a lot of credit for the really creative things it does with computers. It doesn't just make monsters appear through computer animation. It really just does some tremendously amazing, beautiful shots that you never think you could see. And an interesting flick. It's not about television or stage the way that some of our other picks are, and that they're sort of like behind-the-scenes kind of looks at things. You know, this is what would it be like to live in one of these TV shows from this era. And the movie, I think, makes an interesting point that it wouldn't be as great as you might suspect, where everything is, as they say, pleasant and nice. Maybe that's not the be-all, end-all. And I kind of find that interesting as a sort of very complex and nuanced, in some ways, attack on those sorts of old sitcoms.
Yeah, but I'm unconvinced about the alternative this movie proposes, which is that everything would be better if we injected modern ideas into those sitcoms. I'm not convinced of that either. But that said, I do think it is a pretty great movie. It's certainly a funny one, and I do, however, hope that Pleasantville 2, if they make it, will have some monsters in it, though, stomping around on things. I kind of miss that, actually. Number three for me is a fairly recent movie, 1999, a movie called Topsy Turvy, and it's by director Mike Leigh, a guy we should probably have talked about a bit more. He's an interesting director, a British director. He reminds me of Robert Altman in some ways, although his movies couldn't be more different, but he works similarly with the actors. He, you know, a little loose on the script. In fact, he doesn't necessarily show the actors the script right away. He wants you, if you're working for him as an actor, inhabit the character, learn about it, live as this character, research it, do some improv with the other actors, and then maybe find where the story is as a result of this process of working together in a collaborative, improvisational environment where you really have to get the character. It's not just a matter of, here are the lines, now go say them in a convincing way. None of that at all. But Topsy Turvy really feels like he just said, okay, we're going to look at the world of Gilbert and Sullivan when they were first producing their operettas, and let's just see what that time in England was like, what that environment was like, and then explore it in every way we can, in every little angle, every little detail, and it really, really shows. I mean, this, if you want a comprehensive guide to what it's like to produce a play, this is the movie to go see. This has Gilbert and Sullivan dealing with the writing process, with the financing process, dealing with temperamental actors, actors with personal issues, the costuming, the staging of the music, the blocking, the whatever it is about putting on a play, there's a great scene in this movie that gives you the idea of that. And it helps that I love Gilbert and Sullivan anyway. And the story of their making of the Mikado, which is what this movie centers on, is itself an interesting story in real life. And so it really helps that this movie focuses on that as sort of the coat hanger to hang all the stuff of theater on. I love it. Great performances as well. Very memorable delivery of the lines. And yeah, great movie. Seek out Topsy Turvy if you're interested in theater.
Well, maybe I'll have to do it. Sam is doing a good job of picking movies I haven't seen, just so I can't comment on any of them. Okay, well, my number three, and I'm of course just doing my normal thing and picking all the obvious choices because it's easy. My number three pick is my favorite Mel Brooks film, and if I say Mel Brooks and you're a listener of this show, you should know that I'm talking about The Producers from 1968. And an aside real quick, it's really frightening to me that every time I talk about this movie with other people, just sort of like random, you know, friends or acquaintances or whatever, people keep thinking I'm talking about the recent musical version, the adaptation of the Broadway play with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick, and they don't realize that there was an original Producers film from the 60s. That's just frightening to me that this could possibly be the case. But so there you go. Not talking about the Nathan Lane, Matthew Broderick version, which sucks. Talking about the great version with Gene Wilder and Zero Mostel. Ridiculously funny comedy. It's got a lot of the Mel Brooks zaniness, the sort of really quick delivery and cynical worldview that his other films have without any of the kind of annoying parody, slapsticky goofballness that the movies he has that he makes that I don't much care for. Really funny, really sharp, but a couple of guys who try to put on the worst possible Broadway play they can so that it can lose a bunch of money and they can cheat all their investors, who are these old women that Zero Mostel is seducing to get money out of. And so, of course, they produce the play Springtime for Hitler, written by a Nazi, all about how wonderful the Third Reich was, and then accidentally it becomes a gigantic hit, and you know their fortunes are screwed up because everyone thinks it's a satire. A hilarious movie, just an unforgettable final act with them watching the play. I mean, that's absolutely the highlight, is the play and the song that's in it. Just hysterical, really great movie with lots of great dialogue and wonderful satire.
Yeah, it's strange that Mel Brooks started out with this and then wound up doing movies like High Anxiety and Dracula Dead and loving it. I don't know what kind of career path that is. The Producers is a very great movie, and I think that Gene Wilder and Zero Mostel should have been on film more. Gene Wilder was, I guess, but Zero Mostel was a theater guy, and it's really too bad that a lot of his performances are just lost now. If The Producers is any indication, and a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, you could watch the guy all day and be entertained by that. There is another Mel Brooks movie that's worth seeing about the theater, and that would be To Be or Not to Be, the remake of the Jack Benny movie. He didn't direct it, he does star in it. But actually, I would recommend go back to the Jack Benny movie anyway if you're going to go that route, so never mind. Number two for me, All About Eve. Of course, I have to pick All About Eve. It is the best movie about the theater that I know of, from 1950 by Joseph L. Mankiewicz, and it stars Bette Davis and Ann Baxter. Now, one of them is a reigning theater star, but maybe on her way out. Certainly, she could be on her way out if Eve Harrington, the Ann Baxter character, gets her way. She's the up-and-coming star, the next big thing, and there's just a brutal, brutal kind of a war going on. Seldom quite outspoken. There are some scenes, but a lot of it is just manipulation and the ways that strings can be pulled behind the scenes.
Yeah, well, hey, it works out that All About Eve is also my number two movie. You know, lots of great things about this. And again, this is another case where it's about the stage, but it could work just as well for any sort of show business allegory. I think it's probably about as much about the movies as it is the stage. I mean, here it's about an aging actress who's trying to keep her career as somebody younger tries to take it from her. This could apply to the movies even more than the stage. I think, you know, if you get a little, especially for women, they get a little older and still find stage work, but, you know, the close-up of the movies makes it a little more difficult for them, where youth and beauty are, you know, probably required even more than the live theater. But yeah, a wonderful film, and I really like the sort of way that it handles the kind of like almost a Western theme with the young gunslinger coming after the older one. And great drama, great performances, and I mean, just absolutely the best film about the theater. I don't think there's any real argument about that.
Yeah, 1950 was a great year for movies about show business. There was All About Eve, which won the Best Picture Award at the Academy, and also its main competitor was Sunset Boulevard, which we mentioned in Movies About Movies, so an interesting thing was happening at that time. Neat about All About Eve is that it's really about the women, and the men are kind of on the sidelines. It's an interesting dynamic there of who has the power, and you think of the man having the political power and the social power in the world, in the Western world today. Now you have two women who are basically only have each other as a threat, and it's not the men keeping them down or anything like that. It's kind of an alternate reality when you talk about show business versus anywhere else in the world. My number one, I'm sure you picked the same number one as me, but it has to be Network, the 1976 movie about television. Again, we're going to journalism specifically. This is my favorite movie from the 70s. It's about the brutal ratings game behind the scenes. It's about the face that the television stations and journalists put on for the public that are watching their programs, and the disparity there. And there's one guy who just can't take it anymore because he's mad as hell, and he's played by Peter Finch, who is a guy who just snaps on the air and just becomes more and more uncontrollable. Well, the more uncontrolled he gets, the more popular he gets, so the suits behind the scenes can't really pull him off the air, but they really want to. But the thing is, he's really stirring people to action, and he's suddenly saying things that people all wanted to hear, but nobody wanted to say. He's suddenly telling people things and giving people a sense that, hey, they're not being lied to anymore. Things aren't being smoothed over and processed and digested so that the public can consume them. You know, it's like we get pre-chewed media nuggets. But this guy is telling it the way it is, no matter who it offends. And basically, he's going crazy, really. But there is that aspect to him. So you get a really interesting dichotomy of what people are seeing and the people who have to sponsor him. It's a vicious circle. A great list of actors in top form. The film was directed by Sidney Lumet, and I think it's his best movie. A great, great director.
Well, we're running a little long, so let me just go ahead and say ditto.
All right. Sounds good. Let's recap this thing. My number six was Good Night and Good Luck from 2005 by George Clooney. My number five, A Face in the Crowd in 1957 by Elia Kazan. Number four, Bullets Over Broadway from 1994 by Woody Allen. Number three, Topsy Turvy from 1999 by director Mike Lee. Number two, All About Eve from 1950 by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. And number one, Network 1976 by Sidney Lumet.
My top six list consists of number six, The Truman Show from 1998 by Peter Weir. Number five, Moulin Rouge from 2001 by Baz Luhrmann. Number four, Pleasantville from 1998 by Gary Ross. Number three, Mel Brooks' The Producers from 1968. And like Sam, my number two and one picks are All About Eve and Network. One thing that really gets me are those annoying rich kids or rich guys or whoever they are that have their really awesome sports team with their jerseys that have their names on them that all fit. And I just hate those guys. And I like nothing better to show them up with my team of just ragtag guys of misfits who have no training or experience. And yet at the end of the day, we can somehow rally, come together, and show those guys a lesson. And that's why I'm going to share with you a little experience that I have in terms of being the underdog, particularly when you've got some sort of sporting competition coming up. So, you know, if you find yourself in the situation whether or not you're Keanu Reeves coaching a Little League baseball team and learning, you know, how to care again, or you're Emilio Estevez coaching a little hockey team and learning how to care again, or you're Walter Matthau coaching a Little League baseball. Anyway, regardless of the many varied circumstances you can find yourself in, I mean, we can do a lot with our ragtag group. And the first thing you have to do is to really have some sort of personal crisis you need to work out, whether it's you got to overcome, you know, your alcoholism, or maybe you've got to show up the fiancé of the girl you're in love with, or maybe show up her stodgy developer dad, or maybe it's just because some evil kids from the valley are messing with you and you gotta beat them up when it comes to karate. Whatever it is, you gotta have some sort of personal crisis that can intersect nicely with a sporting competition, because you need to make sure that you can manage to intertwine all of your personal problems with some mostly meaningless sporting event. So that's going to be real key, because that'll motivate you. Once you have that motivation, that burning desire to win, you're going to have to find some sort of unconventional coach to help you out. Yeah, it may seem like that crazy old guy down the street just trying to get you to wash his car, but really, you're learning valuable karate lessons the whole time. And, you know, plus, at the end of whatever competition you have, he'll probably come in and save the day somehow. So whether or not it's like some sort of ghost, maybe, that might be a good thing, like the spirit of a former star. Any kind of washed up, over the hill kind of star who used to be great at something can come and help you out. That's who you want. You gotta have someone, though, who doesn't really want to be your coach. So you gotta, like, kind of pressure them into it. Those are the best. You know, the guy who used to be great and no longer wants anything to do with it, get that guy to help you out, assuming that you yourself are not the coach. And if you are the coach, then just know, be unconventional, come up with some unconventional ideas. So a good thing to do that is conventional, but maybe not so conventional, have a training montage sequence or two where you show how wacky and unconventional you are. I mean, not only is it the fastest way to go from being awful at something to being great, but if you're doing sort of team competition, it'll be really helpful because you can see everyone bonding as a team. I found that with my friends, nothing brings together like coworkers or new acquaintances or teammates together like a couple of cool, funny, crisp montage sequences set to some hip-hop music, especially during the 1980s. That was really important then. The pop music, not quite as important for the montage sequence in the 21st century, but I remember definitely during the 1980s. For whatever reason, it was key. Another thing you want to do is to get yourself a ringer. Maybe you'll have to get a girl on your team, which I know it sounds crazy, but that might work. Or a juvenile delinquent of some sort. Or maybe an animal, like a dog, a mule, a dolphin, whatever the heck. Dolphin, maybe not so great for land-based sports. Thinking maybe like water polo or swimming. You want to go with the dolphin. Dolphin, maybe not best wide receiver you've ever had if you're playing football. You might want to stay away. But other than that, it's fine. And look, sure, the other team will complain. He's got a dolphin in this water polo match. That's cheating. Well, that's the time when you can bust out the rule book and say, psh, nowhere in the rules does it say a dolphin can't play water polo. In fact, it's well known that, you know, sporting events really need to place every sort of non-human that's restricted from the event in the rule book, or else you can bring them, and that's completely not cheating.
Did you tell me that a dolphin wouldn't be the best wide receiver?
Mm-hmm.
Because that sure sounds like that you're the rich kid who's oppressing my dream, and, I mean, who could be a bigger underdog than the dolphin who wants to be a wide receiver? Are you telling the dolphin what he can be and what his potential is in life?
I'm just thinking mainly logistically. Would you have to give it some kind of hose to keep it wet?
Well, I know there's certain obstacles that have to be overcome, but all right, how about this? What do you think about a dolphin as my new co-host?
It's going to raise your fish bill considerably. I don't know if you could afford that.
Yeah, that's true. All right.
Otherwise, I mean, the dolphin demographic, that's something you really want to capture.
Actually, not to get too far off the track, but you remember when we recorded that? Well, actually, you don't. We did a Tarzan segment, and we had a dolphin that was my co-host during that, and you were on vacation, I think, at the time.
Oh,
but
okay.
That worked out really well.
Oh, yeah.
I bet you were wondering when you said, like, Tarzan, I don't remember recording that.
Yeah, okay. I sure don't.
That's what that was.
Oh,
right?
Interesting. Yeah, anyway.
It was a dolphin.
So, let's get back to being the underdog. It's important that you play to your strengths. I mean, okay, those guys, they have actual equipment. They've got jerseys that look professional, that kind of thing. What you guys have is lots and lots of heart. So, you know, you have heart, you have a desire to win. Maybe you have the big fat guy who can't be knocked down by the kids on the other team. That's important. Or maybe you just, you know, you have some skanky chicks that you can use to distract the other team while they're at bat. You know, you have the chick, you know, then the guy gets distracted and he strikes out and you can win the big game. Play to your strengths. That's what I'm saying. Be unconventional. Find strategies that work. Now, a note here. We talked a little bit about whether or not it's cheating to have a dolphin play water polo. And, of course, that's not cheating. It's not in the rules. But The other team will also cheat, especially your arch-rival team. That's bad, because they're going to be cheating in mean-spirited ways. Now, there's nothing you can do about this, just so you know. They're going to, like, try and change the rulebook to prevent your dolphin from playing water polo, which is just, you know, that's not fair. They're doing it mean-spirited. They've bribed the refs or the association or whatever. Nothing you can do about that. But when you cheat, if that's your strength, that's just good, fun sportsmanship, because it's in good spirits. You know, your cheating is going to be wacky, like bringing a dolphin in a water polo match, that kind of thing. So don't worry about it, so long as your cheating is in some way comical. So, you know, if you're, like, secretly throwing stuff at the guys when they're not looking, you know, that's funny. It's not mean.
Question?
Yeah.
Let's say that I know of a wacky mad scientist who invented this substance I can put on the bottom of my shoes so that when I jump across the court in basketball, I go 25 feet into the air and I can just jump up and make all kinds of baskets and stuff. No regulation, so not cheating, right?
No, not cheating. Now, this is a sticky situation these days because of all the substance abuse scandals that have really plagued major professional sports these days, but so long as you're not injecting yourself with the substance, I think it should be okay.
Okay, good to know.
Drinking a magical potion or some sort of concoction brewed by a scientist, a little borderline, but I think as long as you're not shooting it directly into your veins, you should be okay. But yeah, definitely stay away from any shady guys who have things they want to rub on you, any kind of creams or liquids that they expect you to inject with a syringe. Definitely cheating, not in a good way. Wacky substances on the bottom of your shoes, lighthearted, fun, not cheating. So when it all comes down to it, the big game, how do you deal with it? The first thing is, like I said, hopefully you've been setting it up all season. You've been setting up a way for your personal problems to intersect with the big game. You know, like you've made a bet with the other team that if you win, the local evil land developers won't bulldoze the local baseball diamond if you win because you're playing against their sponsored team or whatever. Or maybe, you know, this is the chance where you can show your girlfriend's dad that you're not the big loser that he thinks you are, because nothing proves to rich dads that someone's good husband material, like being good at minor league sporting events, that really matters. So this is what you got to do. So in some way, you got to arrange it, depending on which sport you're playing, how you can have them all come together at the most dramatic, tense moment, because that's when your strength, remember, you've got heart, you can pull through, you're clutch, that's what you're going to do. So, you know, maybe you got to make it so if you're pitching, it's the ninth inning, and you're up by one run, but the other side's got guys on all the bases, and they're big sluggers at bat, and the count's 3-2, and you got to just come through and throw one strike and win the game, or vice versa. Maybe you're hitting, and you're down by one run, and kind of just magically hit it out of the park, and that will somehow overcome the father problem or the land developers. That's when you got to do it. You have it all on the line.
Actually, I got a tip about throwing the one last pitch or things of that nature. You might think that a fastball would be most difficult for your opponents to hit, and so that's the one you're going to use to win the big game at the end. It turns out, actually, it's far more effective if you can throw a ball in slow motion.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, or if you're going to make a touchdown, run very, very slowly. It just throws people off kilter or something. I mean, you're just guaranteed. Once you get the slow motion, I think you can only allowed to do it once per game at the end. But, yeah, if you can pull that slow motion bit out, you're golden.
Yeah, any kind of sneaky trick, weird thing is a great thing. Especially if it's been like your signature somehow. If you're playing football and you can bust out some crazy hook and lateral maneuver where you're tossing the ball to everyone all over the field, and that's been like your signature, and you can pull that out, you know, when you've got 3 seconds on the clock and you're down by six. That's really the way to do it, I think. That's awesome.
And do it in slow motion at the most critical moment too.
Oh, for sure. That's when you'll be able to really come through, and that's when we all learn an important message, which is if you try hard enough, you always succeed, just like life. I mean, that's absolutely the way it works. No one ever gets let down if they really, really want to win.
Well, remember way back toward the beginning of the episode? I don't blame you if you don't, because it's been a long haul. But way back in the beginning, I issued a challenge, and that is to come up with movie titles that have numbers in them, counting upward from one. Actually, bonus points if you can start at zero. But anyway, the number one has to be in the title, and then the number two has to be in some other movie title that you think of. You just can't use sequel numbers as your entry. So Shrek 2 doesn't count for the number two. Stephen, are you ready?
Yeah, sure.
Do you want to start at zero, or do you want to start at one?
Zero is easy. The zero effect.
Oh, excellent. Very good. So you get a bonus point.
Okay.
And let's see where you go. The number one now.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Excellent. Oh, I didn't think of that one either. Okay, number two.
Tu Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar.
Oh, slightly cheating, but I'm going to give that one to you. I thought of Too Much, which is also a pun,
oh,
but it's spelled actually T-W-O, and it's a terrible comedy. But anyway, go ahead. Number three.
Three Men and a Baby.
Cool. Number four.
Four Musketeers.
Sweet. Good. It's slightly sequel, you know, a bit, but it's not number four. Okay, I'll give that one to you. Number five.
The Fifth Element?
Good enough. Number six.
Six. 16 Candles?
I think that's for number 16.
Six.
Shyamalan.
Oh, Sixth Sense.
Okay, number seven.
Number seven. 7 Years in Tibet.
Cool. Eight.
Eight. I can't think of any eights off the top of my head. What about, eight and a half.
Oh.
Does that count?
Yeah, sure, why not? It's got eight in the title, even if that's not...
Alternatively, eight women.
Okay, now you're thinking of a bunch. I thought of Hard Eight with Paul Thomas Anderson.
Oh, so wait, it doesn't have to start with a number?
It just has to be in there, yeah.
Oh.
So you're making it even harder yourself, and you're doing better than I thought, so...
Okay, so
excellent.
Let's see.
Number nine.
I got in a blank here. Got a blank. It looks like this might be how far I can go.
Well, you know what? I'll give you a hint. You can always fall back on Bruce Willis movies, and there is one with nine in it.
Bruce Willis with nine. How many Die Hards have they made?
Not nine, unfortunately.
Only four.
Yeah. It doesn't start with the word nine. It's got in it, though.
Right. Bruce Willis with the movie nine in it.
Comedy.
Uh-oh, now you're really throwing me. Bruce Willis comedies.
It's got a friend in it.
Oh, it's that Hitman movie. The Whole Nine Yards.
Yes, and I bet 10 is going to be a challenge for you.
10?
Yeah, 10.
Yeah, actually, I'm not... this is...
Oh, you're not getting it. Well, if you forgot the sequel, Hold 10 Yards, I don't blame you at all, but,
wait.
You know...
Oh, right. Yeah, that is one. It's one of those Four Musketeers
kind of
thing.
But it is
kind of
cheating, yeah. If you can come up with a better 10, that's cooler.
10, 2010?
You know what? That's close enough, because that is one of the words in the title. Okay, 11.
Star Trek 11, untitled J.J. Abrams version. I don't know if that counts.
I don't think so, but Danny Ocean 11. Might help you.
Oh, right. Ocean's 11. But then am I forbidden from using Ocean's 12 and Ocean's 13?
Yeah, that's kind of cheating, but, you know, if that's what it takes to get to 14, where I think it's... I had to look up 14. It's a really obscure movie that, strangely, I have seen, because I've seen obscure movies sometimes, but if you can get to 12
actually,
or 13...
I got better 12 and 13.
Okay,
too.
Sure.
Because for 12 you have any adaptation of Twelfth Night.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And then there's 13 Days in October. The movie about the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay. That's really good. I had to think a lot longer to come up with titles, so I'm really impressed. You want to keep going, or should I just zip down answers?
14, I think I'm going to be stuck on that.
Yeah, I even looked it up on IMDb for the word 14, and I found one movie that I even recognized, and it was called 14 Hours. It's about this guy who's going to jump off a skyscraper, and he spends 14 hours, and they try to talk him down over that amount of time. It's very obscure.
Yeah.
But well, excellent. Well, let me just list through some of the ones I came up with. For number one, I had 1, 2, 3.
Oh.
And for number two, I had 1, 2, 3. And for number three, I bet you'll never see this coming, but I had 1, 2, 3.
I went the easy way.
Well, 4 is the Fantastic Four. Number 5, 9 to 5, and I think I'll be mentioning that one shortly again. Number 6, 6 Days, 7 Nights. I'll leave it as an exercise to the reader what number 7 was. 8 was Hard 8. I mentioned that. There's also, I think, 8 Men Out or...
Oh, right.
I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, Whole 9 Yards, Whole 10 Yards. Also, 10 Things I Hate About You. Ocean's 11, 12 O'Clock High. Friday the 13th. And then I was able to do 15 Minutes, 16 Candles, and number 17 for number 17.
You didn't get up to 400 blows?
Yeah, no. Oh, but, yeah, I'm sure somebody on posting to our website will get up to the 400 blows, and I think I know who that is. But anyway, if you want to give this game a shot with your own titles, go for it. Post it to our website, allmovietalk.com. And that's the end of episode 52, and unfortunately the end of All Movie Talk. Well, keep to our website, though, allmovietalk.com. We'll probably both be posting things for a little while at least, and we'll still have the vintage posts on Thursdays and a couple of bloopers on the weekends. So, you know, there will still be some action going on there. You can check it out there. And also, if you missed it, a couple of weeks ago we posted an unspecial edition of our very first episode. So if you're downloading these off iTunes, you would have missed that. That's something you can go back to that is still waiting in store for you. So allmovietalk.com. Also check out rinkworks.com, rinkworks.com, a site that I will now have more time to work on and provide entertainment there, including some movie-related things.
And so next week, you wait a minute.
Yeah.
Sam, there's... What am I supposed
to... Force of habit there, I guess.
I'm so used to doing that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's just take a moment instead to talk about, you know, what we've done. I mean, there's one thing... I mean, there's all kinds of things that we would have been able to get to if we'd gone on for another 52 episodes, you know. One thing that I kind of regret not doing would be a triple feature on Carol Reed's movies. He made 3 in a row based on Graham Greene stories in 48, 49, and 50. They were Odd Man Out, The Fallen Idol, and The Third Man. We, of course, talked about The Third Man, but the three of those work great together, and I think you should go see them. Steven, do you have anything that you would have liked to talk about and get time for?
Yeah, there's this little independent science fiction film called Primer I'm a big fan of.
Yeah.
If I ever mentioned that.
That's too bad.
I actually did have a Primer spotlight on my to-do list since we started, but it felt like I talked about it enough that didn't really...
Well, you had Melville
actually,
on there, too.
Yeah,
right?
I kept meaning to do a director spotlight on Jean-Pierre Melville, who we've talked about him in a couple of top six lists, I think. Talked about him during the French New Wave, but he's such an interesting director. He made these slick heist movies like Bob Le Flambeur and Le Cercle Rouge and great sort of assassin movie called Le Samurai. These really awesome, cool, crisp French gangster flicks from really in the 50s through the 70s, and has a style all of his own and greatly influenced heist movies and that kind of stuff that came after him, but never really got a chance to talk about him in a whole lot of detail. But if you are interested in him, I recommend his films.
Yeah, so what is it about the French that are so good at crime movies? It's kind of...
I don't know.
Weird.
The French are just good at movies, period. And I think we should acknowledge them. As much as we like to make fun of the French.
Right, we made fun of them enough that we should reinforce that, yeah. There's great French movies out there.
I don't know that any country has sort of... If I'm going to pick my two favorite filmmaking countries, I'm picking the United States and France.
Yeah.
Pretty easily.
I had another thing on my list, the movie Song of the South, the Disney movie Uncle Remus and Br'er Rabbit. Not available in this country because it's, presumably just too politically incorrect for Disney to release, and yet not too politically incorrect for them to release overseas, where the controversy isn't going to be too great. So I think there's some image and money issues at stake more so than racial sensitivity. But, actually, I was going to defend it a little bit. I mean, definitely they're stereotyped African-Americans in the film, but the movie is about getting along with each other, and I think the Uncle Remus character is a much better role model for the young boy who's a star in this than his white mother, who's just, at least at first, not a great mother at all. And it shows white and black kids playing together and getting along, and all the villains are white, so it's like, I don't know, really... to a point, understand why the country is quite so strong. It's a surface reading, I think. And I was going to talk about that. So it's another thing.
One thing that's interesting about that is, I mean, this is a fairly old movie, several decades old, but it's kind of important historically because there was so much controversy about it.
Yeah.
And it is weird. You know, Disney has, like, the Splash Mountain rides at its theme parks, right, that are based on this movie that doesn't exist officially in America anymore. It's kind of unnerving that Disney can just kind of try and make this movie disappear in the United States. I think from a historical perspective, it should be a little bit more available, if nothing else. And, you know, this is one thing I was going to actually talk about, something about how movies react to different forms of media. Because the motion picture, sort of one of the very first forms of mass media, is sort of it and radio in the very early 20th century. And then, so it's kind of reacted to video and television and the internet and all these strange ways. And I think right now, I'm sad we never really got to talk about it, the sort of backwards way the industry has reacted in a lot of ways to new things and the constant extension of copyrights. I think, you know, it's kind of weird that none of this Disney stuff seems to ever fall out of copyright. There's no way that we'll ever be able to see Song of the South legally unless Disney in America decides that we can. I don't know, there's something that's kind of unnerving about that. I feel like these movies are shared history. And, how long should they be allowed to just sit on it in a vault and not let anyone see it?
Yeah, I do think it should come out. And that's one of the reasons I'm so pleased with Warner Brothers, which, has not yet released its most controversial cartoons. That is true. However, you know, I've been talking about the golden collections they release every year. Wonderful DVDs and absolutely not cut either the violence or the racial humor that is present in them. And there's even a warning, this is for adults only.
Have they released?
So I appreciate that they've done that.
Have they released any of the crazy Japanese, anti-Japanese Bugs Bunny stuff yet, or the World War II cartoons?
I don't think so, but they have been releasing those private snafu cartoons that a lot of the Looney Tunes directors went in and made, and they were written by Dr. Seuss, actually, who did the writing for them, have a very Dr. Seuss flavor, but in a very different context than we're used to them. But these were educational films made for the American servicemen, and consequently didn't have to conform to the standards of releasing something to the general public, and so they're a bit racier. Did play pretty fast and loose with Japanese stereotypes, for example. I mean, they were addressing a wartime situation. They're actually educational films, in a sense, for the troops. Like, here's what can happen if you aren't very careful about telling people where you're going and when your mission is and all that stuff, because and then it shows these beautiful women who are really Japanese spies seducing poor little Private Snafu and then transmitting the information to the enemy. Those are actually on those DVDs, so yeah, they're doing all right in terms of being forthcoming about their history.
Yeah, the thing is, who's going to care if Disney were to just quietly release Song of the South? Would anyone? No one's going to run out and buy it, except for Disney geeks and film historians.
I think the question is more who they market it to. As long as they don't market it to children, I think they can sidestep a lot of the controversy. But they've also dug themselves into a hole because it's famously unavailable. And so if they were to do it now, it's more of a deal. I don't know. I'm hoping that things will turn around. I think people are becoming more understanding of the fact that times were different 60 years ago. So, I don't know. Might not happen for a while. But
it just seems like you could figure out a way to bring these out, even if you put them in as part of a package that was more of like a historically oriented Criterion Collection type DVD thing.
That's the way to do it.
And that's something we never actually really talked about that I always kind of wanted to. Talk about the Criterion Collection. If people aren't familiar with it, I think probably most of our listeners are. It's a company that originally they released special edition Laserdiscs. They sort of actually created the entire special edition Laserdisc and the director's commentary idea on Laser, and now all their stuff's on DVD. And they just released fantastic DVDs. Back when we were doing these sort of DVD preview type segments, I think we talked about some Criterion discs, but nobody does as good of a job. Every now and then, somebody like Warner Home Video sometimes does great jobs with some of their older stuff, but on average, nobody does as good of a job presenting as much restored material and really interesting critical and historical type commentaries on their discs as Criterion does. And they have a really cool range of films. I mean, these are the same guys that released like Ozu movies and also Kevin Smith movies as part of the Criterion Collection. It's a very strange and does a really good job, actually, of covering film history, not just American film history, but international film history, too. So if you're ever looking for just a movie to buy or to rent, you happen to see a Criterion disc, I think you can make a pretty reasoned assumption that it's a movie that's worth seeing at the very least. Even if you don't like it, it might still be something that's of some importance.
Well, good. So at this point, yeah, go to our website. Is All Movie Talk coming back in the future? We've gotten all kinds of questions about that.
I don't know. Certainly not the way it is now. This is way too much work, I think, to do this weekly hour. This is a lot of work. When I first came up with the idea for this and pitched it to you, I was unemployed and had a lot of free time. So it was certainly a lot easier when I was between jobs to do this. And now, you know, both of us had actually changed jobs since we first started doing this, I think.
Yeah.
And well, I mean, I got one. I didn't change one, but you've changed jobs, and we had a lot more work and long commutes, and I don't know. I wouldn't mind doing maybe a special Oscar episode sometime in the future or something, but I don't think we make any guarantees. I don't know how you feel about that. We haven't talked about it, really.
Yeah, we haven't. This is the first time we've even brought the subject up. I'm open to the idea of having specials, but yeah, I think this is the end of the official weekly segment-based run, so...
But hey, you know, you can always just leave the feed in your iTunes or whatever, or keep the website bookmarked, and you know, if we updated it, it just magically would appear when you download it, if we updated a new episode or something like that. So one nice thing about podcasts, not like it takes up any space, just to have an extra subscribed podcast in your list and just magically get it when we put out a new one, if we put out a new one.
Yep. Okay, well, thank you for listening to us. A lot of you have listened to us quite faithfully over the last year, and we really appreciate that and the encouragement and everything. Well, that's it. Cut!
So, that's it, huh?
That's a wrap, yeah.
We got a wrap party or something?
Thank you for being here, everybody. A wrap party.
We gotta have one.
Yeah.
It's hard to do that over Gizmo or Skype.
Right. We'll find a way.
You know what we really need to do?
What's that?
We need to fade to black.
Fade to black. Yeah.
I don't know how to do
this. This is audio.
Right. What's the equivalent?
How do you do a fade to black if it's just audio?
I don't know. I don't.
Just
really
like
think
you fade
do.
Out
just
with the
like an album or something like the fade out where the album song just ends. Well,
let's do that.
We're just going
to let's be talking like we are now.
Okay.
And does just the volume goes down and down, and then
should we be singing?
Because
you always hear them singing in the songs. I don't know if we need to be singing. Just talking is okay.
I don't think anybody wants us to be singing.
Oh yeah, you're probably right. So I guess
we'll just fade out.
Right, it's
going to
fade out.
Quieter.
It's going to get quieter. I'm still. Yeah, am I supposed to start speaking quieter, or are you going to add that in later? I'm not really sure. I'm talking very quietly now. Probably nobody can hear me.
Okay.
Nope. Very quiet.
Okay.
Fade
quiet
out.
Like this.
Fade out.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Fade out. Fade out.
Then we're all gone.
Okay, we're gone.